Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. As you know, this show features guests with many helpful thoughts and advice on how to improve yourself. But often you listen to this podcast, nod your head, and find yourself unchanged until the next week. This week's guest, Caroline Arnold, will attempt to change that. Her book, Small Move, Big Change, will provide key rules on how to turn those resolutions into reality when it comes to weight loss, saving money, enhancing relationships, and getting organized. We usually fall flat on our face after proclaiming grand plans of how to change. We'll be talking about our limited stores of willpower against the powerful habitual behavior that needs changing. With personal and real-world experiences, she'll expose us to the craft of making micro-resolutions that could propel us straight past failure. I'm real excited to talk about a self-help that actually works. Caroline, welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I enjoyed reading all about all the change science that you've been putting forward in on.
Yeah, I mean, that's been actually my whole life is neuroplasticity, changing the brain. Mm. You know, my commercials change the way you think, you change your life. Mm. And people all the time make, you know, they make the gesture of making changes. Mm. And I think that it's so often a smokescreen. Like, once you say I'm going to do it, then that's all you have to do is say it. Mm. So first question for you is, what made you motivate the book? Was it about yourself? Hmm. Or was it about what you saw in others?
It started with myself.
Well, you look perfect. I don't know what you need to
change. Oh, well, no, I'm far, far from perfect. Even after many, many successful micro-resolutions, and I don't think perfection should be the goal. But I was like 92% of people who make these big New Year's resolutions. As you say you're going to be somebody different. I'm going to be thin by summer. I'm going to be organized. And I would... You know, 92% of people fail at those resolutions, and I was part of that 92%. And I was so hard on myself, and I couldn't understand, like, why is it that I'm able to do a lot at work and juggle a family, but the one thing I tell myself I'm going to do for myself, like go to the gym several times a week, lose weight, whatever it is, that after a few weeks it collapses. And I ended up 1 year sort of taking a step back from a failure and instead sort of took a look at my behavior in a very different way and tried to find one pivotal behavior to change that was so small and so reasonable that I couldn't fail at it. And in doing so, I saw sort of the profoundness of making, the significance, let's say, of making a behavioral change that lasts a lifetime, even though it may seem small, and how that rippled through other things. And I began sort of moving my focus from one behavioral change to another until I was making more progress than I'd ever made before. So it started with me. Then other people kind of in my circle noticed changes in me and asked about it, and I sort of started explaining that I was making these micro-resolutions and sort of what the rules I had sort of constructed for myself, or a framework, let's say, for making change and why I felt it was successful, why I felt it worked. And they began making changes, and they would report them back to me. And often these stories were very interesting. And
I think the support system also is one of the key ingredients to making changes. When you have someone to answer to, that's why people change when they have close friends, is that you have someone every day to simply report back to. I tell people who don't want to exercise, I say start with one push-up and one sit-up a day.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then you just add one and one, because if the change is too big, you're not going to do it. I do want to underscore, when you first said profound, I think you were right. Mm. It's not just significant.
It's
the reason why it's profound is because it actually works. If you start small, then you eliminate the excuse that I can't do it.
Yes.
Okay, and you realize that going to the gym may be... It's about exercise, and you could start by exercising where you are.
Yes, exactly.
You know, starting is important, right?
Yes, and getting to your point about neuroplasticity, if you create a new behavior, it becomes a pattern for other behaviors. So if you take clutter, for example, you know, my first non-cluttering thing was, it sounds so tiny, was to hang up my coat when I came home and not throw it in a chair. And the first time I went to hang up my coat, the closet was so jammed I couldn't even find a hanger. So right away, I had to fix that. But it was such a small thing. I had to hold my feet to the fire, because if you can't do that, you have to say you're not serious about changing. But over time, I began just I no longer have clothes on chairs, because I created another pattern of sort of behavior that sort of, you know, bled through other areas, like areas of my life, until it took hold and managed other things for me.
And you actually said something that I want to underscore for our audience, is that neuroplasticity is the way in which the brain rearranges itself neurologically, so that that which is rational and cognitive is the frontal lobe. The frontal lobe is able to actually have dominance over the emotional brain. Mm. And most people operate out of that child brain, that emotional brain, that is very whimsical, makes a lot of promises, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, but really doesn't have the willpower. But when you make consistent behavioral changes, you actually not only change your behavior, but if you go get a scan of your brain, yes, you see that your brain itself changes. And that's the profoundness of hypnosis, and it's the profoundness of what you're doing.
Right. It is true. And no change did I make in my own life, no matter how small it may have seemed, turned out to be tremendously significant and changed my outlook, changed my worldview. Because in that autopilot place that sort of you're operating out of most of the time, which is a good thing because you don't want to have to think to tie your shoes, right? You want those things to move into
right,
autopilot.
Right. Those are A1 atomic, you know, unless you're Einstein, can't change your shoes.
Right. Yeah.
Tie your shoes.
Exactly. I mean, beyond that, to actually disrupt that and get a new behavior in there, what's in that autopilot also are attitudes and values and things that you've learned. You can change your attitude through sort of repetitive self-messaging, too, if you keep it narrow. And that will actually change the way you look at life and how you interact with others and how you talk to yourself about yourself. And I was amazed by that.
Oh, you're bringing up such great things. Mm. Okay, so the brain doesn't know the difference between reality and imagination. Mm. That's why people get frightened when they have dreams. Mm. And they'll wake up full of perspiration, mm, because they experience something that in their mind is reality.
Mm.
So when you in your head go through the changes you're going to make, the micro changes, mm, you're actually going to experience those changes just by thinking about them, and you have a much better chance of following them through. But I always like to put people on the spot. Mm. What changes in your life did you want to make, and why?
Okay. So I wanted to lose weight.
You look great.
I lost weight.
How much did you lose?
22 pounds.
Oh,
after
my
many years of swearing I was going to lose weight and being done with
the
it by March.
The girl looks great, guys.
That's amazing.
And girls.
I'm really the fittest I've ever been. My house is not, there's neat and then there's neat. I'm the neatest I've ever been. So I don't have piles of clothes. My bed is always made. But there's other things that need attention. Not every drawer is perfect. But, you know, you go as far as you can. My spending is better. I was wasteful in that way.
Talk about the spending. How did you get the spending under control? And what advice? Every husband now, now you have their attention.
Mm.
Okay. How do they get their wives to spend less? Mm. And yes, some men are the spenders, but you know, at the end of the day, they usually turn around and say, I'm the earner too. But that's not always true. So how do you get a person to spend less?
Well, first I'd say that person themselves has to want to spend less.
Why would they want to spend less?
Because in my case, sometimes I would, you know, order things late at night when willpower is at low ebb. I would go on shopping late at night as entertainment. And then during the week, things would arrive. And I'm like, what's this? And I'm like, oh, that. You know, then I would sort of kick it. I didn't really like it so much. I'd kick it under the bed. I'd forget to return it. The window would pass. And that I felt was sort of, you know, very wasteful. So I did make a micro resolution. I do not do leisure shopping on the internet after 10 p.m. at night. I do not open anything that comes through the mail from an internet purchase unless I'm absolutely prepared at that moment to wrap it up and address it and get it ready to go back, instead of sort of separating those things. Actually, my first micro resolution to save money was not to pay an ATM fee. because I always value speed and convenience over everything. So I worked in a building where the ATM in the bottom, which was the most convenient, it may have charged $3. So if you're taking out $100, that's 3%.
That's 3%.
Yeah. If you got a tax hike like that, you'd be very unhappy.
Right. But let me ask this question. Now, see, here's where I would agree and disagree. I agree that we do things because of convenience. Having said that, how much is your time worth? Meaning, I find that people who will go out of their way for 45 minutes, okay?
That's crazy.
It's crazy because then are you really worth $6 an hour or $4 an hour?
Yeah. Convenience, though, is very expensive and it plays into a lot of things. If you're taking a lot of cabs because it's convenient, you're not walking. If you're going to the ATM that's right there and you tell yourself you can't walk three blocks, you know, how are you really living your life? Because you're just rushing from thing to thing to thing. That's why one of these changes can be profound.
Have you spoke to my wife?
No.
I'm just wondering.
But, you know, I'd say for me, the ATM thing, it did change me. So, like, right now, I can't imagine the crisis that would make me pay this ridiculous fee.
And the crisis is
and
how
I paid
long,
it all the time.
How long would you walk before you pay the fee?
Oh, you know, I'd walk. It depends on the circumstance. If it's a beautiful sunny day, I might walk 10 blocks. If I was late to the radio show, so, I'd pay the $3.
So now you're bringing up an interesting issue, and it is the most important issue. People need to decide who they want to be as opposed to what other people want to be. My whole life, I was literally painfully thin for me because I'm broad-shouldered.
Mm.
So at 5'11", I was like 155. It didn't look good on me.
Mm.
Now I'm absolutely 20 pounds overweight without a doubt.
Don't look overweight.
She's being sweet. I am. And you know what? I haven't decided yet whether or not I care.
Exactly. Why should you change that? I mean, we all have things about ourselves we want to change. It really is about your priority for yourself and not what other people want for you. So if you can afford to spend and you enjoy spending, and that might be a behavior you enjoy. Golf is expensive, okay? So maybe if your leisure activity is buying nice things, as long as you don't find yourself feeling very bad about how much you've saved, potentially as I thought I didn't save enough, et cetera, you shouldn't have to change those things. It's funny you bring up something I think is very important. The language of resolution often revolves around being different, you know, to be organized, to be on time, when really change is about doing something differently. And people, being different is a someday proposition. One day I'll be that person I want to be. Why daydream, to use your talk about imagination, about being someone different someday when you can do something differently today?
It's a great point, but the answer to that would be once you know who and what you want to be in terms of your identity, then the doing comes from the being. If you say to yourself, I am an athlete, that's my identity, and that's the identity I'm comfortable with, It then lights the fire. Well, if you're an athlete, then you need to do something about it to actually look and behave and act like an athlete. So what happens is making resolutions for me, for people who don't really have a clue, as meaning it sounds good to lose weight, but you have to ask yourself, well, what does that mean? Does it mean you want to live longer? You know, I'm not so sure if I want to live to 80.
Mm.
I'm not so sure if I want to grow old. I haven't made that decision yet.
Mm.
You know, I need to always be vital and active and participate. As long as I could do that, then I'll live to 120. But I'm not into, I wouldn't make a decision to prolong my life, you know. So you need to know those questions.
Well, the way you imagine yourself, of course, is very important, and it does lead to behavior. But sometimes all there is imagination, and then when people fall short of that ideal, they do nothing. You know, I think one thing is we overestimate. We really count on will and imagination to carry us forward, and it will for several weeks. But I think, I don't know how, you know, willpower, one of the things you asked me how I wrote the book, part of it was my own, you know, exploration of this for myself and my own coming up with a framework that worked for me every time. Part of it was a lot. There's stories of a lot of other people in the book contributed their experiences and the changes they made and what it led to. But then I did research as I was writing the book to kind of say, okay, if I'm really writing about willpower and I'm writing about habit, I need to know more. And I was fascinated to see kind of how the research sort of aligned with my own experience. And one key piece of research for me was, you know, willpower is not a function of character. It's a limited neurological resource. And when you stress it too quickly, it just gives out. I mean, people don't break their diet first thing in the morning. They break their diet at night. People go into a mall with kind of often with a clutch on their pocketbook, but by the time they leave at the very end, they get into the line, and there's all these things there designed to get your attention when your willpower is at low ebb. Because decision making and active initiative share that same store in the brain with willpower. So at work all day, you're doing decisions, you're using your active initiative, and you're tamping down the willpower space. So for me, understanding that focusing precious willpower narrowly to get a result was important. But I don't discount the power of wanting to be a different
person.
See,
you gave some insight before in terms of willpower. When you said after 10, tired, maybe I had some wine with dinner, I'm not going to do that. So part of willpower actually, part of it is the preemptive thought and dialogue, the internal dialogue. Internal dialogue is so important because it then gives you the ability to execute. And when you execute, just like no one wants to go to the gym and no one regrets going
right
after they went there.
Yes.
But I want to go back to something. Tell me what steps you actually took, because all the women are going to want to know this and some of the guys.
Okay.
To lose the weight. What
okay
are the micro steps?
I love it. So my first...
Because if I decide I want to lose the weight, I might take your steps.
Okay. So my first micro resolution, which I should stress is something that you have to repeat over time to sort of make it part of the mindless autopilot space, was never to eat a conference room cookie again. I worked in a, firm where in the afternoon you'd walk into a conference room and they had brownies and blondies and oatmeal, chocolate chip, all this stuff. And I would eat at least one of these ginormous cookies during these meetings every day, at least one. And then I kind of leave in a kind of a food coma and then crash later. And I told myself, I'm never going to eat one of those cookies again. I can bring my own cookies. I can eat cookies after. I didn't say I'm never going to eat in a conference room
the
again.
Reason I love, been, the reason I love what you're saying now and why everybody's laughing, okay, and not realizing the significance of it, is that if you take a teaspoon and put it into a jar of peanut butter and lick the peanut butter off the teaspoon, over a year, you will gain 7 pounds.
Exactly.
Okay, so don't laugh at this cookie, at this of what Caroline just said. She's right.
Yes, it was huge, but what it did was sort of arrest the upward trajectory of my weight. I didn't lose, but I stopped gaining when I did it. Then I'll just list the ones I did. Each one, everyone should know, I framed very carefully. I had a cue for, and I practiced over a period of time. One was not to eat after dinner. That was a big one.
Oh, that's the hard one for most people.
But, boy, what a change that was. I told myself I could have whatever I wanted for dessert at dinner, but I was not going to eat afterwards. And I didn't always want dessert. First, I went to bed sooner because you eat to stay awake at night. That munchy thing you get at 10 o'clock is you're not hungry, you're tired. So I got more sleep. I woke up hungry for breakfast, something I hadn't experienced in probably 20 years because I was eating another meal at like 10 o'clock at night. So people say, oh, yeah, I don't eat breakfast in the morning. I'm not hungry. Maybe because, I slept better because I wasn't digesting all that food. And, by waking up hungry for breakfast, I sort of reestablished a connection between appetite and eating, which I had kind of lost by snacking all day long. And I started to experience the pleasure of eating a meal when hungry. And that gave me ideas for other resolutions. One was not to eat while I was cooking. Okay, I make the family dinner, and I'd have a glass of wine. I'd have a piece of French bread, right there to your point about that teaspoonful of peanut butter. One was not to eat well, I helped clear up because I do like to cook and I make nice things. And I'd see that like my kid hadn't eaten. And I think, well, I can't just throw that out. I gave that up. A big one, which took me a long time to master, was to eat slowly. I was always the first one done. And once you're done, there's nothing left but the bread basket or seconds because everybody else is still enjoying their meal. And that one was interesting because I'd like to make 2 points about it. One, making a micro resolution to chew your food slowly is very unappetizing. So I reframed it to dine leisurely and savor my food and drink. So it's very important to frame it in a way that you want to do it.
I mean, the words, and this, by the way, everyone has a different lifestyle. My hours here are 8 in the morning. I'm here in the office by 7:30, and I leave at 11:30 at night.
Wow.
So I'm eating dinner usually around midnight.
Wow.
Okay. So everyone has a different lifestyle. So one has to make these changes within one's lifestyle. And you know, because you could, so one of the things that I would do if I were going to make those changes is I probably, number one, would use smaller plates. Because at night, I have a glass of wine, I could eat the house.
Mm-hmm.
So I would use a smaller plate and I would just make it, okay, I'm not going to go back for seconds.
That works. Another one for me was to always leave something on my plate, because the cue to go get more is the empty plate. So as soon as you can see yourself in that plate, you start thinking about more. So my battle is just to leave a piece of something tasty on my plate. One other point I want to make about chewing slowly, which I think gets to other points you've made, is because it was an isolated change, you're listening on a very clear channel. It's like a scientist that's only changing one or two variables at a time. The strangest thoughts would occur to me when I tried to slow down my eating. One was, if you don't hurry up, you'll never finish all this food. Okay, never had I realized that rushing to finish my food was actually some sort of goal I had in mind, like to be first. And when I realized that, because it occurred to me constantly, hurry up or you won't finish. And I slowed myself down, and I did indeed end up not finishing because my brain caught up with the fact I was actually full. I started examining other places in my life where rushing was counterproductive. I had really kind of made a virtue out of rushing, that I could do everything faster than everybody else. And I looked at places to unwind that, you know, when I was with my kid, when I was doing something like gardening. So that's to your point about profound change.
And the reason why, by the way, for those who are asking the question, why is eating more leisurely important? Because when your body breaks everything down into glucose, whatever is not used as energy is stored as fat.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take a longer time to eat, then you're going to use the food, the calories, as energy, and it won't be stored as fat.
Exactly.
Now, what do you think of the idea? Because I was thinking of either smaller plates or give my wife a taser, and that she would tase me after the first plate and I would be out and sleep.
Either one. I would say there is a new study out that you should know, Dr. Glenn.
That would actually, that's what it would take when I'm really hungry to get me not to eat. But
yeah. Listen, I think the most important thing is what you said, small plate occurred to you as a strategy. It is like reverse engineering your own behavior to find the shift, and that's the shift you've identified. It's like I'm a technologist. It's almost like debugging a routine. I looked at my routine. I looked at why I was late, and I changed one thing that I wouldn't be late for that one reason again, like I couldn't find my keys, let's say. And bit by bit, I just debugged my routines to the point that I felt that they ran well enough for me, to your point. Like, I don't feel I have to have a perfect household, but I don't want to see chaos, right? I want to have some sense of order. So we all have to achieve. I'm more organized than I've ever been, but I'm not the hyper-organized person.
That's not who you are. How important is it having a vision, not only an identity of who you are, but a vision of what you want to accomplish in the process of making these micro changes?
Okay.
Because I think it's extremely important, but I want your opinion.
Well, two things I think are true. First, I want to say about identity that often when we make changes, we go for identity first and hope that our behavior will align. But when you do change your behavior, your identity changes. I mean, it follows over time because your preferences for living change as a result of making a change and being successful. In terms of the long arc of what am I trying to get done with so many small changes, of course I knew I wanted to lose weight. But one thing I discovered for myself and I write about in the book as one of the principles is that If you only look at a small change as a step to a larger goal and you just kind of discount it, this is something I have to do to get to the thing I really want, then you're much less likely to be successful. So, for example, if you're trying to declutter your house and you say, I'm going to make my bed, that's what you're going to get. Maybe people say, how pathetic, she didn't make her bed. I didn't make my bed. I had to teach myself to make my bed, and that's when I got a made bed out of it. I didn't get a sparkling household. However, when I'd come home and see in my bedroom how nice the bed looked and how bad that chair looked covered with clothing, it did suggest things to me. at first, making the bed, this is something people should understand. When you change your behavior, it's effortful, even when it's small. It was effortful for me to do it. I wasn't good at it. It took me
long. Until it becomes a routine, and then it becomes effortless.
Exactly.
And that is, meaning the truth is that routines become automatic behavior because neurologically your brains change.
That's
you know,
right.
Back to neuroplasticity. It just does, it works a little faster with hypnosis, but it works. But having said that, I want to ask this question. Why do you think, let's go back to weight. Why is it that in different periods of time, women and men, that their weight were, they were admired at different sizes? Mm-hmm. Why now is there such a push to be thinner?
Well, you know, I think I'm certainly not the expert on this, but I can draw some hypotheses. You know, being portly was a sign of being wealthy. It was laborers who were fit, right? Other people had servants and were leisure. And then it changed, you know. Just like suntanning used to be a sign of being a day laborer. Then it suntanning became a sign of leisure. I have time to lie on the beach and get this beautiful tan.
But for someone who's just guessing, you actually hit it on the nail. Mm. You know, you see, you weren't guessing. You knew those answers.
I didn't know all of them. I did know the one about the tanning.
Those are good answers. Those are actually true. As values change, yes. then so does behavior change. Now, you mentioned the word here, cues.
Yes.
Explain what a cue is. Is it similar to a trigger? And
yes.
How does it fit? How does it fit into change?
Okay.
Okay. And the only thing that doesn't change, by the way, is when you're dead. You're either going to progress in life or regress in life. Those who think that you're going to stay the same are kidding themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's a law in physics called the law of entropy, which means energy always seeks a lower level.
Right.
In other words, everything turns to shit.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, unless you do something about it, it's going to deteriorate.
Right.
So that's why I love the idea of micro changing, because otherwise you're going to go from a cluttered house, you know, to a place that is uninhabitable for guests.
Yes, when people give up dieting, they think, okay, I can live at this weight. But guess what? Their weight goes up.
Exactly.
I mean, you have to work to maintain. Yes, let's talk about cues. So I mentioned the empty plate. You know, when I see my empty plate, that was my cue to get up and go get more food because other people didn't have an empty plate and I had an empty plate. So I made that micro resolution to make sure I left something on the plate and got used to the idea that finishing was not my goal. And that finishing, the reward for finishing soon was not getting another plate. Understanding the cues you respond to. If you go to the gym and one day you go and you see the vending machine on the way out and you treat yourself to a candy bar after your workout and you do that a few times in a row, after a while you get the Pavlov's dog thing where when you see it,
sure.
You think, gee, I'd really like to have that candy bar. So your micro resolution may hinge on identifying that cue and disrupting it. Not every cue. Let's take something with relationships.
Okay, so disrupting it simply means to actually either avoid it or to reinterpret it.
Yes.
Okay.
So to catch it.
So you catch it as a cue, and this is
have a different response.
Correct. And this is why I say that. Let's say for a drug addict, when a drug addict falls, it's because he thought about it most of the day and he wound himself up.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah.
Okay. And when someone falls from any addiction, is they wind themselves up and then they say, I slipped. And I tell them, you didn't slip at 5 o'clock. You slipped at 1 o'clock.
Right.
If you would have called me at 1 o'clock, you wouldn't have slipped. But I want to ask this question. Give me some cues. Give me some micro movement for having a better sex life. And for having more romance and intimacy in a relationship, marital or non.
Well, again, I was going to talk about relationship cues, so that's very interesting because those can be the hardest ones to catch. You know, I think a lot of people would say what happens in the bedroom at the end of the evening was determined by what came before. And I'd say one thing you can do is if there are things that cause sourness or friction between you and your partner leading up to it, I would examine those things as the killers of some of that. So I'll give a personal example. I
was hoping you would.
I work on I don't know that it'll end up with some personal details on sex, but I go off early in the morning. I take my kid, get her off to school. I go to work at my job on Wall Street. I come home. I have the value of having a family dinner, so I make dinner.
That's great.
But my and I And my husband would sometimes come in and say, I was making dinner, you know, you left the light on in the basement this morning. And I would feel this surge of resentment, you know. But I'd hear myself apologize immediately and then launch into an explanation about why I'd left the light on.
You're Jewish?
Yes.
Which
was
really...
Are
you
sure? Yes.
They need to check your genetics, girl, because I don't know about that.
Yeah. And my husband would grow silent because, of course, my explanation was really a make-feel-bad moment. Like, I do this, I do that, I do this, I do that. And here you're telling me I left the light on. And one, this was my first relationship micro-resolution. I thought to myself, gee, what would happen if I just didn't apologize when I didn't mean it? Because I didn't mean it. What if I just acknowledged that I heard it? What if I just said, okay, oh, got it. And a magical thing happened. This event happened. My husband spoke about something I might have done better. I started to feel myself, got the cue, here I come to explain, make you feel bad. And I stopped myself and said, you know, okay. And then he stepped in. He filled. I didn't suck up all the oxygen, which you might say might be a sort of a Jewish thing. I sort of left a space there. And he said, I know you have a lot in your mind, but I thought you'd want to know. And the whole evening was saved. I didn't carry that baggage all night. He didn't feel like, gee, I can't say a thing around here with that. And I never realized that I was doing that and putting him in that position and making, you know, until I changed my behavior once. Then I got the, you know, listening to somebody, someone in the book talks about their husband, who had a different schedule from her, would stay up late at night. He did creative work, but often he would sort of watch movies late at night. And then the next day he would tell her about them. And she hated hearing about these movies. She found it boring, some of these movies she had seen. And maybe deep down she had some resentment that she had to go to bed early, get up early, and he had this different kind of schedule. But it seemed to be so important. And one time she thought, what would happen if I just gave him my whole attention when he told me this thing at dinner and didn't, like, give him all these signals, like, looking away? Why are you telling me this?
What would happen if you would have said to him, say, honey, you know, I did leave the light on, and just also because, you know, now that we're talking about it, I spent $22,000 on jewelry this morning, and you look great. You really do, and I'm so glad I married you.
Yeah,
exactly. How would that work in your house?
Yes, I think that's great. If you had a micro-resolution to find a reason to praise your partner every evening,
right.
I guarantee you, if you change your behavior never to say I told you so, that would be huge. Your sex life would definitely improve if you did
and
that.
I'm gonna add to that. Not only don't you say I told you so, because at the end of the day, my favorite expression, it's not we don't or shouldn't look at life as the negatives. It's what do you say positive?
Yeah.
There's a verse in the scripture that says life and death are in the power of the tongue. How about going over and saying, you know what? You and I are far from perfect, but I would never want to be or spend my life with anyone other than you.
Yeah.
How great is that?
It's great.
And
magical.
It's magical. So rather than – because what happens is – you don't want to get into a pissing match, oh, because life is not equal.
Exactly.
It is not equal. If you were lifting a couch with your husband, you could not, you know, you look like you're 125 pounds or whatever you are, and I'm sure he weighs more than you, correct?
He's tall and slender.
He's tall and slender. So he's 175 pounds, 180 pounds, but he probably has more muscle mass, so he may be lifting 80% of the couch. But you know what? When two people are rowing the boat together, they don't have to row at the same speed.
Yes.
And with the same strength. They just have to appreciate the fact that each one is giving 100%.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you're looking for justice in every interaction and perfect balance, you're never going to get there. I mean, some people, some people are more outgoing. Some people are, you know, more outwardly caring, praising, and other people have more kind of will and inner strength to make things happen for the family. I think, again, you know, if you're always in every interaction trying to get to parity, every interaction is going to be found wanting because that just doesn't exist.
Right. And to throw this in, sometimes I because I'm Jewish, I pick on Jewish, you know, women, but it so often they are driven to accomplish things. And they instill that within their children, you know, that life is about making changes and getting somewhere and not just simply, you know, not just simply doing what you have to do to get by, but to really want to make your mark, you know. So For all those Jewish women out there who think I pick on you, I do, and I will continue to do so. But I want you to know I appreciate the other side of the coin. Let's continue about words. How important are the words we say to others and ourselves in making changes?
I think very important. I spoke about, you know, one of these changes I made, the one about chewing my food slowly being unappetizing and I didn't want to do it, and reframing it as to dine leisurely and savor my food and drink. If you think about just, I mean, it sounds maybe like a crass comparison, but how advertising works, you know, it's that thing of finding the language that penetrates people so that they want to do something, they want to behave, or they identify with, they feel they have a better identity because of your product or whatever. It's the same when you talk to yourself. So, and when you talk to other people. So, for example, a lot of people are defensive, they're defensive, and this gets back to cues. You could be defensive in every situation. You could be defensive with your kid, defensive with your partner, defensive with your peers, defensive when your boss gives you feedback. That's what we call it now, developmental feedback. Not criticism, it's developmental feedback. And those are all cues. And if you tried to solve for all those cues to never be defensive in those situations, you'd go on tilt. But you might say, when I do get this developmental feedback from my boss, you might think about exactly what you're going to say, almost as a patterning, like, thank you for telling me that. Thank you for taking the time to tell me that. I'm going to give it some real thought. You don't even have to agree. You know what I mean? You don't even have to say, oh, you're right. Just give space to yourself.
You know what? You're so right. But I will say this. The first rule of terrorist negotiation is that when they get louder, you get lower.
Yeah, I do that with
you know,
good. Yeah.
You don't back down, okay? And you could always say, you know what? Let me think about it, you know, take it into consideration, because anything you say, I take into consideration if it's your boss. You know, clearly, though, on a personal level, you will always find that if you, rather than say you don't look good in blue and you say you look amazing in red, you're going to get a better response.
A different result. It's funny that you say that, because one of my more recent micro-resolutions for myself was to reread some of my emails before I send them, to switch them to make sure that whatever I'm saying that is kind of – sometimes I think, well, this is just so efficient. Say, you know, this doesn't seem right to me. I think we should do X, Y, Z for this, this, and that reason, and just send off these terse messages that seem to me efficient and smart, and I always just assume the other person is smart, and if they don't like what you say, they're going to push back. But not everybody feels that way. It doesn't take a lot of effort to say – gee, thinking about what you said, I wonder if we thought about it this way. What do you think? I mean, you're basically saying the same thing, but you're not shooting down something. You're just saying, hey, I heard what you said, and it occurs to me that this might be. And at a certain point, if you're the decision maker, you might have to make a decision. But it's just a better way to engage that costs you nothing, and it's habitual. So it's like by training myself to read some of these more important mails and make sure that I'm not sending off something that just seems to me straightforward, efficient, and neutral, but is going to be received as a ding by somebody, to take the ding out of it before I send it. It's easy.
I think that's great advice. You know, what flashed through my mind is the difference sometimes between people is that Jennifer Aniston movie when she says to the boyfriend, I think, or the husband, I don't remember which one, I want you to want to do the dishes. Mm-hmm. And he says, why would I want to do the dishes?
Right.
I mean, I'll do the dishes, but you want me to want to do the dishes? Give up on that idea, okay?
Yes.
If a person doesn't like something and they're willing to do it, okay, don't go over and say, aren't you happy you did it? No, I'm not happy I did it. I did it because I love you, and I did it because I want to make your life easier. But I don't have to enjoy the things that you enjoy. So one of the things I would say is don't try ever to get a person to agree with the way you think.
Right.
Get them to understand the way you feel, and that your actions could really make their life easier. But couples fight because they want to win an argument of what's right.
Exactly. And you want the person – often if you want – I found sometimes if I want my husband to do something, the best thing is just to ask him to do it and not have him come to the conclusion like I should be doing it. Or like, and people pick up – and it can be the male or the female, and I'm sure he does this – they pick up extra duties and they want other people to notice and take some of it off them, and they don't think it's fair, but they don't ask. But then when they ask – you're right. You can't then say, isn't that fair or doesn't that seem right? If the person's going to do it, they're going to do it. You don't. If they say, yeah, I'll do that, I'll take out the garbage. Do you really need to get that other affirmation that that's what's right and just? Just get the garbage taken out. Was that your goal? Or is your goal something else? Because if your goal is something else, handle it a different way.
I like your rational mind. I'm going to throw this in because people, some people believe that that makeup sex after fighting is amazing. You know what? Not fighting will cause you to have more sex, okay? And to allow the other person to be who they are, and if something truly bothers you, to address it in a way that doesn't blame the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that you there's enough good things, because in life there's nothing that's 100%, you know, it's 51-49. That's, you know, there's a compromise in everything.
Yeah.
What was the hardest thing that you had to do, by the way, to, like, what's your diet like now? What do you eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? I'm curious.
Okay. So we got through a number of changes I made. I made many more, like not to eat in line and things like that. I generally eat oatmeal in the morning. I love breakfast. It's now my favorite meal of the day, where before I often skipped it. I might eat some sort of low glycemic granola with some yogurt on it. Love all that stuff. Very seldom do I eat something like a muffin or something. I don't say that I would never. It's just not part of my routine. Then for lunch, my latest lunch is I eat a lot of this baby kale, and I have pumpkin seeds and all these things. I'm not at all a vegan, but during the day I tend not to eat meat or rich foods. I just find I stay lighter, perform better, and then when I come home and eat dinner, I eat whatever I want to eat. I always have fruit. I do eat dark chocolate probably every afternoon.
Dark chocolate is good for you and will cause you to lose weight if the cocoa is over 70%.
Yeah, I love that.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And then at dinner, you know, I have a glass of wine, sometimes more, but I'm happier with just a glass. I feel better. I don't have a lot of capacity, so I feel better if I just have one, but I do love the glass I have. I drink a glass of water for every glass of wine. I eat, I eat usually some sort of, sometimes it's meat, sometimes it's fish, sometimes it's pasta. And then I might have some little something after dinner, but, a piece of fruit or something like that, and then I'm done. And I wouldn't say that I don't ever slip from that. The times that I enjoy, but I think the important thing is I got there by degrees, and I love everything I eat. I enjoy everything I eat, and things that didn't taste good to me before taste fantastic to me now because I learned to enjoy them.
Right.
But the times I really slip are if I don't get enough sleep. If I don't sleep, I'm tired all the next day, and I just crave, because I'm low energy and because they know now that there's a couple of hormones that if you don't get at least 7.7 hours a night, the hormone that signals satiation and the hormone that signals appetite get out of whack so that you're hungry all the time and that nothing you eat really satisfies you. And we've all had that experience. I mean, you keep going from desk to desk at work eating people's M&Ms and then eat something else until you're disgusted with yourself. But you don't really feel satisfied. You just feel kind of sick. And so I really try to – sleep's a big one for me. And I used to pride myself, I can go 2 days without sleep.
I think sleep is extremely important. I think it's also important, and you mentioned something, it's important that you allow yourself a day to cheat. Most people don't know this, that if you're on a food plan and you take a day and you really cheat and then you go right back to being good, you'll actually lose more weight. Mm. The problem that most people have is once they cheat once, they continue to do it.
It's that thing
it's
of
almost
one...
like it's like I took a cigarette, now I have to keep smoking.
It is.
And if you could avoid that, if you,
you could have anything.
You could have anything.
Anything.
Anything in moderation actually
anything.
Is great. Because my during the week I work a lot, I don't eat a lot during the day. My wife does make me dinner at night and I don't sleep enough, but I never ever genetically needed to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I didn't really have that problem. It was a genetic abnormality, actually, which runs in my family. So 2 hours of sleep is plenty.
Wow.
Yeah. Now I'm older and now 4 hours of sleep is plenty. But I'm never tired and not cranky and I wake up full of energy and I go to bed full of energy. But that's not normal, which there's a lot of parts of me that fall into that category. The thing that I wanted to pick up on is that you have microed yourself into loving the things which you do.
That was
now, how did that work with savings? What else did you do besides the ATM?
I did a number of things. I noticed I had a lot of waste around convenience. I had a lot of waste around sort of low will, you know, shopping late at night. Another one was being very sort of vulnerable in sort of situations where you're sort of in a shopping situation where someone sort of leads you to an option which is more than you want to spend. And you have that feeling of, you know, well, not being good enough to shop in the store or something if you can't buy this, whatever it is, that feeling of please, often not to disappoint the salesperson with me, because I have that thing about not wanting to disappoint people. And for in those situations where often I would end up buying something more expensive than I had intended, I trained myself to say, to think about language, as soon as I saw it, I'd say, you know, that's more than I'm planning to spend today. I memorized saying that because it basically says it's not that I can't spend it. That's not what I'm planning to spend. I didn't pretend to consider it and reject it for other reasons.
But I heard something in your thinking that I want to address, and that is that you cared that the person thought that maybe you couldn't spend it.
Yeah.
And the rule of thumb in life, okay, is you need to follow your own values and not care what other people think. This is the crux.
Mm-hmm.
Most people's anxiety and fear, which is, in fact, the crux of their problems, is they put too much weight over people they don't even know.
Oh, so, yes.
Okay?
Or
people who don't know them, and that could even be relatives, to care what they think. You could have just told the person, you know what, let me have 10 of those. No, let me have 20. You know what, forget it. I don't want it.
Yeah. Another one was to walk away. If I'm having that kind of desire to run out of the store with my prize, you know, but, you know, it's almost that feeling like, let me just spend the money before I reconsider, because if I really considered this, I wouldn't do it. I forced myself when I have that feeling to say, okay, I'm going to think about it. And I go walk away for 10 minutes. If I do that, I seldom go back. If I go back, I know that maybe I really want it. But some of it is just getting caught up in the excitement of the high of a new purchase.
Right.
You know?
So if you walk away, this is actually really practical.
Yeah.
If you walk away, okay, then you know what? Most of the time you won't go back.
Right.
Okay. And if you do find yourself going back, then you have to ask yourself whether it's a habit or an addiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And that's, by the way, that's how you know what an addiction is. An addiction is when you engage in a behavior that begins to destroy your life and is completely opposed to your value system. Okay. But
you know, another big one was I systematically removed – I looked at I thought, you know, it's probably not the vacation I take, but it's what I – it's those, you know, things you spend every single month. I looked at all the – you know, we had a storage space. We had a service for doing garbage things. We had all of these things in place that made the monthly nut higher than it needed to be, and I systematically squeezed that down because everybody wants to be able to splurge. I put in micro-resolutions in place, and this happened over a period of years, everyone should know, to have a review period every quarter of bills that you think are just baseline bills, like gas and stuff like that. And I, you know, I got a different gas supplier. I got all of our phones on a different plan.
So
and these things
really,
take
– you really managed your life.
And I had never done – I was kind of like, I don't have time to look at the fine print here, you know.
You know, if you manage your life, then at one point you're going to manage your thoughts.
Mm.
And then the only thing that I would add is to manage or to create what it is that you want to experience and what it is that you want to, in the end, build.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you say, you just don't want to maintain a healthy lifestyle. You want to have great experiences. Because what is life without great experiences?
Mm-hmm.
Financially, who runs the finances now? So you or a hubby?
You know, it's sort of split. It's different. I mean, my husband has a set of assets and things that, you know, he came into the marriage with, real estate and other things that he manages. I sort of do, you know, I have my own income and I'm free to do a lot of things with that. You know, we definitely share the wealth, but in terms of whether it's little by wealth, nobody should not big wealth, but whatever it is we have, we share. I just say the responsibility sort of divided. So I would probably make a lot of the decisions around things like, you know, can we afford a monthly gardener or whatever it is? You know, what about the contribution we're giving to XYZ? I probably have more of those daily things, and he probably has more some of the longer term investments, but it's sort of split. And I think I think it's hard. Sometimes you partners encourage each other to do the wrong things. Oh, yeah, you should get that, you know.
Well, you know, sometimes they do it because what they say is, listen, you're worth it. You deserve it. It's a big deal, so we have more debt. That's why you need to ask yourself, what is life really all about? But what you have to do is you have to communicate.
Yeah.
The great thing is lots of times, all the time, in relationships, there are different roles.
Right.
But it's so important to know the role of your partner and for him to know your role and to be able to share and talk about it, even though you still manage it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, as opposed to, well, you take care of that and I have nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and sometimes I'm guilty for that because I have a different role than my wife does, and I'll just not listen to why she wants to explain to me why her decisions are important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a good idea to actually hear that.
That's a good idea to hear each other. Yeah.
Yeah, it usually works.
Yeah. I feel I'm far from done in the space of.
What's the next thing you want to change? What's the next micro thing you want to change?
Well, I'm working
on it. She wants to put on 22 pounds, so she's going to micro change that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have a number of things kind of that I'm working on. I'm always working on two at a time. You know, some of them have, one of them right now has to do with something I want to shift about the way I operate at work, which I already talked about, which is this business of the emails. And then I have a personal one. I do think that two at a time is a good rule of thumb. You just don't have that much willpower and focus to see these changes through. And people say, Jay, well, you know, I'm so screwed up. I can't just do two. I have to do 100. Well, 100 won't work. But if you do two at a time and you keep them sort of an average of 4 to 5 weeks each, that's 20 permanent behavioral changes you're going to make this year. That's huge. Because the basic tenet of behavioral science is most of the time what we do is what we do most of the time. Every once in a while we do something new. So if you can actually disrupt your personal autopilot with 20 behavioral changes this year and 20 next year, and you know, you're going to make a lot of change.
Yeah, I think that always writing things down, keeping a diary, using a calendar, you know, making yourself responsible to people, making yourself responsible to yourself is also, it's an excellent thing to do. But you're right. You're right. If you make small changes, you're going to get huge results.
Yeah.
You know, now it's interesting. One of the things that I saw my producer write is about decluttering, and he wrote, most geniuses are messy. But I want to go on record to say so are most morons.
Mm.
So it being messy is not necessarily a reflection of intelligence, but it's also a reflection on the fact that everything, if we show everything respect, you know, our clothes respect, our space respect, and to realize that we give ourselves then less work if we deal with things immediately. Don't put things off.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that's exactly right. Like when I said that one of mine was to hang up my coat when I came home, the language I used, I told myself, it was really more of a suggestion, it's really just as fast to hang it up, I told myself. It's really just as fast to hang it up, which understood the value I had that it's so fast to toss it in a chair. I sort of disrupted that value thing. It's not so far from that to it's really just as fast to file it. Because when you say, okay, this is actually faster to hang it up now than to throw it in a chair and come back and hang it up later, you do get there. But again, it's what you're comfortable living with. And I think one other thing we haven't touched on, you know, a lot of people are very neat. They were raised to be very neat, and that's part of their autopilot.
Right.
And so it doesn't cost them anything to be neat. If you weren't raised that way and you didn't get those skills, it will be effortful over time to acquire them. So don't acquire them if they're not something that you think improves your life. There is something wonderful about, like, I don't live a completely ordered existence, but the order I have mastered, I cherish because it supports me in my life every day. It's just one thing. I don't have to be, you know, like this business of improvising everything is very expensive mentally. It takes away from other creative efforts. If you have to improvise to be on time every morning, like, oh, yeah, I didn't do that. I should do this. I got to go get that. Oh, that's upstairs. You're going to arrive at your job with less, or your creative activity with less than if that ran like clockwork.
That's right.
So that's what I'm trying to
do. You know what I tell my clients the secret of being on time is?
What?
Being 20 minutes early.
All right.
Okay, meaning if you shoot to be on time, you're going to be late. If you shoot to be 20 minutes to a half an hour early and you relax and unwind, have a cup of tea, then you're going to be on time.
All right.
So when you know that something, by the way, is difficult, it's just like with a teenager. So my advice with teenagers, when parents tell a teenager, you know, you need to be home by 12. Never tell them that. Mm. You would tell them you need to be home between 10 and 12. Mm. This way they have a two-hour window and they get to feel more adult and to choose when they come home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so always kind of give a little bit more room.
Mm.
You know, for those who are thinking, you know, you pick up a book on metaphysics or black holes or something that's really deep. But I want you to realize that in life, it's the little things that count. And that's why Carolyn's book is so significant, because it is adding up all those little things, those little changes. You will not only change thousands upon thousands of people's lives, but you're going to change your belief in the fact that you can change. Because so many people don't change because you'll hear them say, this is the way I am, this is the way you married me, this is the way you got me, I'm not going to change. And if you don't change, you're going to regress.
Yes.
Okay, so always go forward. What a pleasure you are,
and what
a great book you wrote.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for this opportunity to reach your audience. I really enjoyed our conversation. It was fantastic.
I did as well. Have a great day.
Thank you, Dr. Gluck.
Keep making changes.
Yes, absolutely. It's youthful. Change, youthfulness.
I want to once again thank Caroline Arnold for coming onto our show. Pick up a copy of her book, Small Move, Big Change, on Amazon.com. And follow her on Twitter at Caroline L. Arnold. And also be sure to check out her website on CarolineArnold.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I am your problem solver. You need to check out our other episodes and tell your friends. Gluck Radio is exploding. GluckRadio.com, there's something for everything. And if you need to actually reach me because you want to change something in your life, you call 212-599-3195 or go to GluckSolutions.com to find out how, if you change the way you think through neuroplasticity, you could change your destiny. Till next time.